he's still dealing with the question that started in verse 1 of chapter 8, and that is now concerning the things sacrificed to idols. This is the underlying issue that's being dealt with in this section. In fact, we pointed that out whenever we got into this part of the letter where he starts out with now concerning. That seems to be a major division of each of the sections of this portion of the epistle. That turned up too loud. Rick, would you lead us in a word of prayer, please? You know, in chapter 8, he's made it clear that the Christians need to be concerned about the influence that they have upon others, and in particular those who are having difficulty coming out of that pagan environment and the practice that they have of, of worshiping in the pagan temples and the eating of meat that's been sacrificed to idols. And of course, he makes his essential point is it doesn't really matter to God what you eat, but what does matter is people's adherence to their conscientious convictions. And you don't want to cause someone to sin against their conscience. He deals with this in Romans chapter 14. So it would be natural for the people who already have some questions in their mind about Paul's apostleship and his authority. And this again is kind of an underlying theme in this section, and that is the authority that that the apostle has, for him then to defend himself, because they're thinking, okay, you're telling us this. You're telling us we ought to be real careful about the influence we have on other people when it comes to eating these meats and so forth, and the liberty that we have. But in the back of their mind, some of them undoubtedly are thinking, we see some inconsistency in you, Paul. Because when you're with the Jews, you behave one way, and when you're with the Gentiles, we see some differences, and it looks like to us that you're not real consistent with what you're telling us to do. And so then the question comes up, well, is he really an apostle? That is in their mind, in his detractors' mind. And who does he think he is to tell us what to do? So he's defending his apostleship. He's defending his right to speak to them and to underscore the fact that what he is saying is the will of God. He has the authority from God to give these directions to the people. So that's the sort of the backdrop here of his initial statements here in the first part of chapter 9 about his freedom, his rights, his right to and his relationship to them, as far as the fact that he was the apostle that had a great deal of he's the one that took the gospel to the Corinth, Acts the 18th chapter. And so they shouldn't be questioning him. They knew who he was. They knew that he had the signs of an apostle. But memories sometimes fail and are short. Ed?
What was he doing differently with the Jews and the Gentiles?
Well, I'm going to get ahead of myself, but over here toward the latter part of the chapter, he says, to the Jew I became a Jew, and then he talks about the Gentiles. And he observed some of the Jewish customs, especially their traditional practices. He would go along with them and participate in those Jewish rituals, and which apparently could also involve abstention from eating meats, certain unclean foods. We'll talk about one when he was in Jerusalem, also when he was in Caesarea. From appearance standpoint, he would be going along with Jewish customs and practices, And then he'd turn right around and tell the Gentiles, well, you know, for example, circumcision is nothing. And then he would kind of look like a Gentile on other occasions. And so that was, that disparity there was a question that was in the mind of some of the people. And we'll deal with that when we get over there to that portion of the text. Okay. But these are essential rights. And his defense is that he had the right to do these things, to eat and drink, verse 4, which would have to do with dietary restrictions. To have a wife, just like Peter. And then verse 6, are only I and Barnabas have we not a right to forbear working? These are rhetorical questions. He illustrates it like this, this matter of his right to have to provide for his own sustenance, apart from support from the church. And I will touch on that in just a minute. He said, you know, if you just look around and you just look at life and the normal experiences of what people do and what happens, just think about this. What soldier ever serves at his own charges? What would the answer to that be? None. No. And so there's your military metaphor. Here's a agricultural metaphor. Who planted the vineyard and eateth not the fruit thereof? Well, every farmer that plants expects to reap a crop that's going to provide some food for him. And a shepherd metaphor. Or who feedeth the flock and eateth not of the milk of the flock? Well, they all do. Everybody does that. That's it. I mean, okay, we've got the picture. Well, then he says in verse 8, do I speak these things after the manner of men? In other words, is this just something that is coincidental to life? Or is there something more here that we need to be thinking about? Again, in terms, remember, Paul's defending his apostleship and his right to act as he does. Well, he's observed it from the human viewpoint of human experience, and now he's going to turn to what the Lord has said about it in other places to reinforce the principle from a biblical standpoint. For it is written, verse 9, in the law of Moses. So now he goes back to the law of Moses to show that here is a divine decree. Here is, we've seen the mundane, if you will, application of it. Now here's the divine decree that relates to this subject. Thou shalt not muzzle the ox when he treadeth out the corn. Is it for the oxen that God careth, or saith he it assuredly for your sake? When God said that, don't muzzle the ox when he treads out the corn, was that just to make sure that you didn't starve the oxen? No. There was an intended lesson that was much bigger than making sure your ox eats. And it was the application of it extends all the way to the first century in the church in Corinth. He said, assuredly he said this for our sakes. There is a relevant application to this issue that Paul is dealing with that is rooted in that statement back there in Deuteronomy chapter 25. Well, what's that, Paul? Well, yay. Yes, for our sake it was written. Because he that ploweth ought to plow in hope, and he that thresheth to thresheth in hope of partaking. If we sowed unto you spiritual things, is it a great matter if we shall reap your carnal things? And again, another rhetorical question. And the answer is obvious. What is the obvious answer to that last question? Was there an intent that Paul and or the preachers and teachers should reap carnal things, material things, as a result of their labor and their work in preaching and teaching spiritual things? I hear some head shaking. Yes. All right. Yeah. Absolutely. God intended that they would reap carnal things, that is, material things. Just like soldiers did, just like farmers did, just like shepherds did. Yes, preachers too. They have to eat. They have to have clothing and shelter, etc., etc. And apparently others had, in fact, done that. Verse 12, if others partake of this right over you, do not we yet more? Nevertheless, we did not use this right. Now, herein is another bullet, I guess, in the ammunition that Paul's detractors might have, and that is, here's the logic. Well, if Paul has the right as an apostle to be supported by the preaching and teaching that he's done, then why didn't he do it? He didn't take any support from us, that is, in Corinth. Which the suggestion would be, well, if he didn't take any support, then maybe he doesn't have the right to have it. Maybe he's not an apostle. Maybe he's just blowing smoke. So he's going to explain why he didn't take support from the church in Corinth, which answers the question about, does this mean, are you an apostle and do you have the authority to be telling us what you've been saying? Well, before I get to that, I need to take a breath and let you ask any questions or make any observations up to this point.
When he referred back to Deuteronomy 25, the Jews that were there should understand that the Levitical priesthood, who were to be given spiritually, were taken care of with carnal things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because they had no land or anything else, it was all given to them by the people, or given to them by God through their offerings to the people.
Right. You know, they... Even the pagans should have understood it, because the pagan priests were supported by, supported in their work. They got their food, clothing, and shelter as a result of the work that they did too. So even the pagans should have grasped the principle. Whether Jewish, were you talking about the Levitical priesthood, or were you talking about pagan priests? Still work, that principle is true in either case.
Nancy? Have they had any experience of somebody not accepting the support?
Well, there's no indication of it in the text. And maybe that's why they were so quick to judge Paul.
Right, because he was the one exception to mm-hmm. their experience, Jewish or pagan.
Which would...
The person should have received support.
Right.
But
mm-hmm. Yeah. Jim?
Back in verse 5, Paul asserts his right to be married. So why does he qualify with believing wife? Does that impose any criteria on a normal Christian to marry a believing wife?
Well, the we here is the apostles. We, rest of the apostles and Cephas, and brethren of the Lord and Cephas. I wasn't here last week. What did your teacher say about that?
Kept my mouth shut.
Oh, he observed the Passover on that, huh? I don't know of any other scripture that restricts or limits that. In fact, Peter makes it clear in 1 Peter that when you've got a believer married to an unbeliever, that relationship is acceptable to God. 1 Peter 3. So if there were something inherently sinful about having an unbelieving wife, I've never been able to understand why Peter wouldn't have said something about that in 1 Peter 3, when in fact he encourages the believing wife to set the right example for her unbelieving husband so that she might influence him for good. And the same thing in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. When Paul speaks of the believer and the unbeliever, and the unbeliever is content to dwell with the believer, then he says, that is a good situation and a good relationship. And in fact, in verse 16 of 1 Corinthians 7, he talks about the possibility of the believer influencing the unbeliever to the extent that the unbeliever becomes a Christian. So if there was anything that was inherently wrong with having an unbelieving spouse, certainly it would come up in one of those texts. Now, why he put believer here, I don't know. I don't know.
Just to speculate, could it be that he's so dedicated to Christ that he wouldn't even consider marrying an unbeliever?
Well, he was so dedicated he wouldn't even consider getting married, period.
I know, but that could be what he had in mind when he wrote that.
Like you say, it's speculation. Yeah. So I don't know. No. Okay. Okay. Verse 12 now. Nevertheless, we did not use this right, but we bear all things that we may cause no hindrance to the gospel of Christ. So herein lies the reason that Paul forbear receiving support from the brethren in Corinth, is that he did not want to do anything that could hinder the cause of the gospel. Now, that opens up a whole can of worms and questions that we don't have answers to. And that is, what would have been the reason that it would have hindered the gospel? The only thing that I could speculate about is that Paul would have been accused of being a mercenary, because he was in Thessalonica. He was accused of being a mercenary. That, oh well, Paul, and in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, again, in a more exhaustive defense of his apostleship, in verses 15 and following, and we'll get to that eventually when we get over there, but it becomes very clear that Paul was being accused of being a mercenary, and that what he was doing, he was just doing for money. And so, knowing that that apparently was an issue, then Paul made a preemptive strike. And that is, rather than giving his enemies the ammunition to say, yeah, see, I told you, look there, he just wants the money, then Paul didn't take anything from them, because he didn't want to give any of those people one shred of evidence that they could twist to attack him. Now, that's speculation, although it's not pure speculation, because we've got what he says. We know what happened in Thessalonica, and we also know what he says, excuse me, 2 Corinthians chapter 1. So I think that's the best guess, and it's a semi-educated guess, as to why Paul chose this course. But we know what his motive was. His motive was that he wanted to make sure that the gospel would not be hindered in his work in teaching and preaching the gospel.
Doesn't that last part of verse 12 tie everything back into the last verse of chapter 8? because it's, he's not talking about just drawing the money there. He's talking about, but we bear all things, and we might cause no hindrance to the gospel. You know, he's foregone having a wife. He's all these other things, too, is tied into that.
And the choice that he makes about whether or not he eats the meat that's been sacrificed to idols and so forth. Yeah, it's comprehensive. Yeah, it includes all, well, he says, bearing all things. So it is a comprehensive statement. Okay. Now, this is where he also includes the pagans. Again, the principle. Know ye not that they that minister about sacred things eat of the things of the temple, and they that wait upon the altar have their portion with the altar? That would apply both to the pagan priest as well as to the Levitical priest. So, because Corinth is predominantly Gentile, he inserts this so that the Gentiles there, who would not have an insight into the Jewish law, even though there were obviously Jews there, you know, Aquila and Prisca had been exiled from Rome, and there, so there, you know, there were people with Jewish background there, but this would cover the waterfront. And again, it's a rhetorical question, and the obvious answer is, well, yeah, sure, we know that. And then he says, all right, now the Lord, again, has something to say about this. We're not just talking about human traditions. We're not talking about cultural practices. No, this business of the priests, the ministers, those that minister, partaking of the food, of the fruits of their labors, it's consistent with what the Lord has said. Even so, verse 14, even so did the Lord ordain that they that proclaim the gospel should live of the gospel. I used to have this nutcase that would call, when I was in Beaverton, that would call and rant and rave regularly. And one of the things he liked to jump on was that if you really love the Lord, you wouldn't be taking money to preach the gospel, and there was no authority for paying preachers. How on earth anybody can read this text and say that there's no authority for supporting preachers of the gospel, it just beyond my comprehension. But he wasn't the only nut that took that position. I had a 21-year-old kid with only half a brain take the same position when I was in Washington. I don't know if that's unique to the Northwest or not, but...
Carl Kitcher's side took that position,
didn't he? Oh, yeah. There's a bunch. Yeah. Yeah. How you could... What else could it... How else could you understand that passage? The Lord ordained that they that proclaim the gospel should live of the gospel. Now, the only answer I ever got to the position that I just mentioned was, oh, this only applied to the apostles. I said, well, in verse 6 he included Barnabas, and Barnabas wasn't an apostle. Oh, yeah, Barnabas was called an apostle. Oh, yeah, well, that was in the context that Barnabas was one that was sent by the church in Antioch. He was not an apostle in the sense of Paul and the others. Well, he was still called an apostle, so this only applies to apostles. You see, that's where I got some of this gray air.
See, that way the church in Huntington Beach could send you to Garden Grove and pay you where they can't pay you.
Yeah, that was another, this 21-year-old that I mentioned. He was okay with sending money to the Philippines to support a preacher over there, but not a local, not a located preacher. Well, that guy was located in the Philippines. Oh, yeah, but he went around to other churches. He just didn't stay at one church. I just have to tell you this because it reminds me of W. Wharton, and I think he recently died, but he preached meetings all over the country, well-known preacher for 70 years. And he traveled back and forth across the country, and he liked to drive. He had an Airstream trailer that he pulled everywhere he went for a meeting, and so he drove back and forth across the country a lot. And he said, one day when he was driving between Barstow and Needles, and he was looking at all that country out there, he said, you know, this would be a perfect place. I said, well, what are you talking about, Brother Wharton? The perfect place for what? He said, well, I've got this pet project. He said, you know, I was thinking about buying a couple hundred thousand acres of that land out there between Barstow and Needles. And he said, I'm going to put this fence. He said it'd probably take about a 10 or, you know, 15-foot fence with razor wire on top of it to keep the people in there. But he said, you know, about 200,000 acres would probably hold the people that I want to put in there. And I said, well, what are you going to call this, you know, place that you're going to buy out there? And he said, oh, well, that's easy. You just call it Belly Acres. So the Belly Acres, we know a good spot for them. The ones that close their eyes to the scriptures and have their pet hobbies. Oh, well. But again, now Paul comes back and he says in verse 15, but I have used none of these things. That is, as Paul mentioned a moment ago, having a wife and the support and all of the other rights. He said, I've used none of these things that it may be so done in my case, for it were good for me rather to die than that any man should make my glorying void. Now, that raises another question. Well, what is it then that Paul has to brag about and boast about? He certainly can't boast, well, you know, I went over there and I preached the gospel in Corinth and they supported me and, boy, I've just, you know, everything's just hunky-dory. He said, you know, verse 16, oops, it was already there, wasn't it? His answer to that is in the form of what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 4 fours. F-O-Rs. There's a progression here. It's like a bam, 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 bam. There's a progression here of a chain of thought that answers that question. For if I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of. But wait a minute. I thought that's what your life was all about, was preaching the gospel. Well, let's keep it in the context now of what he has said about his choice in not receiving support. He said, for necessity is laid upon me. Oh, you mean you got it. You just have to, you can't hold back. No, that's not what he means. For woe is to me if I preach not the gospel, for if I do this of mine own will, I have a reward, but if not of my own will, I have a stewardship entrusted to me. Now he goes back to that principle of stewardship that he talked about in chapter 4. On what basis was Paul preaching the gospel to the Gentile world? Did he just decide Corinth would be a nice place to go? What motivated him to go to the Gentiles? Christ. Christ told him that. Remember Acts 26? I'm sending you to the Gentiles. So here again now, he's come full circle and he's back around defending his apostleship because he is one that was sent by Christ to the Gentiles. And so, therefore, he has the unique position of being a steward of the gospel to the Gentiles per the instructions that were given to him by Christ. So he's right back now to answering any of his detractors who say, well, Paul, you don't have the right to be telling us this and da-da-da-da-da. No, he's preaching the gospel not so he can brag about it or some other motivation, because he had committed himself to the task of carrying out the Lord's instructions. Now, he's not doing it just because he feels like his arm's getting twisted either. Don't get that impression. For if I do this of mine own will, verse 17, I have a reward. But if not of my own will, I have a stewardship entrusted to me. What then is my reward? Well, it's not bragging. You don't have bragging rights. You don't have money. So what are you doing this for? That when I preach the gospel, I may make the gospel without charge, so as not to use the full of my right in the gospel. For though I was free from all men, I brought myself under bondage to all, that I might gain the more. And to the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain Jews. To them that are under the law, as under the law. Not being under myself under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law. To them that are without law, as without law. Not being without law to God, but under law to Christ. That I might gain them that are without law. To the weak I became weak, that I might gain the weak. I am become all things to all men, that I may by all means save some. And I do all things for the gospel's sake, that I may be a joint partaker thereof. I've got verse 23 highlighted. That is the crux of the matter. Not to gain bragging rights, not to put feathers in his cap, not to, you know, for any other ulterior motive. No, he preached the gospel. He was a faithful steward to the charge the Lord had given him, so that he too could partake of, or be a joint partaker of, the reward of the gospel. So, and then we're going to go back. I'm not going to observe the Passover on some of those naughty questions that you probably have on these other verses, but we need to get the big picture here before us. And that should be the motive of every preacher, and in fact, every Christian that endeavors to teach others. It's not for any personal ulterior motive or gain, although some do. And Paul talks about that in Philippians, you know, those that have ulterior motives in preaching the gospel. The true motive is that we are servants of Christ, we are slaves of Him, bondservants, and that we all have the same goal, and that is to receive the reward. The inheritance is incorruptible and undefiled, that fades not away, that Peter talks about. And we want other people to share in that reward. And that's what drove Paul. Now, let's go back to verse 19. Again, he talked about his freedom, you know, and he, you know, he introduced the chapter with this rhetorical question: am I not free? Well, of course he is. Right. So he said, though I was free from all men, I've got a notation there that I think helps, at least in my mind, clarify what he's talking about. I think contextually he's talking about men's scruples. Again, you go back to chapter 8. the eating of the meat, the sacrifice to idols, the right to do that or the right to forbear it. Yeah, he had those rights. But he was not bound by them. He was not bound by men's scruples, by men's traditions, or by human practices. However, he said, I brought myself under bondage to all that I might gain the more. Now, if you let your eyes kind of scan down this section, he says that, what, four times in my text. At the end of verse 19, that I might gain the more, about the middle part of verse 20, or latter part of verse 20, that I might gain them. Verse 22, to the weak I became weak, that I might gain them. And then, of course, at the end of verse 22, that I by all means save some, which is essentially just another way of saying the same thing. So, again, this gives us the insight into his motive and his means and his methods. He wanted to gain these for the law, for the cause of Christ, which required him, going back now to verse 19, which required him to willingly forego some of the rights that he had, and in fact brought himself under bondage to others. How so? Well, to the Jews, I became as a Jew. This relates to the question Ed asked earlier. If you look at Acts chapter 21, I think we have a divine commentary on that verse. At least it's the only one, it's one of the ones that makes sense to me. Whenever Paul had come to Jerusalem, you might remember that he was vehemently attacked by the Jewish leadership. One of the suggestions that was made was that in order to sort of defuse the situation, he should participate in this ceremony of what appears to be the purification ceremony of the four men that had taken a vow, which apparently was perhaps a Nazarite vow or something like that. But Paul was asked to purify himself with them and be at charges for them. And so you say, well, why in the world would he do that? He wasn't a Jew anymore in terms of he wasn't practicing Judaism. Why would he do that? 1 Corinthians 9 explains it. I became a Jew, that is, I participated in and practiced some of the Jewish traditional rites in order that I might gain a Jew, might gain the Jews. I wanted to have a positive influence on them so that they would be receptive to the gospel. So, you know, whenever he shaved his head, it's in Korea. I suspect that it was a similar thing. Now, it wasn't just to the Jews that he was accommodative. And by the way, by his observing or participating in these Jewish ceremonies, he was not being hypocritical. Because he was not saying, you've got to do this to be saved. You remember he had Timothy circumcised. And that was long after the conference in Jerusalem in Acts 15, which settled the question of whether or not circumcision was essential to salvation. Yet he, and I think this ties into what we're looking at here, why would he take Timothy and have him circumcised when circumcision was nothing? He, in fact, Paul says that circumcision availeth nothing and uncircumcision availeth nothing. Wow.
The Jews in that area knew that his mother was a Jew.
Okay. So, just to, again, eliminate the possibility of the criticism that, well, Timothy wasn't even faithful to his Jewish upbringing. Because, look, he wasn't even circumcised. So how can we have any respect or regard for him? Because he wasn't true to the Jewish custom when he was born. Well, by having him circumcised, Paul takes away that objection. Yet Titus, he didn't, because Titus had no Jewish heritage. So he didn't have Titus circumcised. So never in observing any of these Jewish customs, practices, or ceremonies does Paul even hint at the idea that, hey, you've got to do this to be saved. No, he is just participating with them as a Jew, which, you know, he was. He was a Pharisee of Pharisees.
Nothing that Paul did ever conflicted what the scriptures say that you need to do.
Right.
I've heard people say, well, look, Paul did this, so that means we can do this to gain these others. But that's not what it's saying.
Mm-mm. No.
He didn't go against what God had taught.
No. The law was clear. Well, this was a ceremony of the law. This is what, you know, that they practiced, and so he could go along with that because he was accommodating himself to the Jewish practices and traditions because he was one. He had been reared in that. And that's what he says here. That I might gain Jews. Now, the next phrase kind of is a little bit puzzling. And to them that are under the law, as under the law, not myself being under the law. Well, he's talking about the law of Moses there. Well, but why would he say this? It looks like he's just being redundant because he just talked about becoming a Jew and now he's talking about the law. Well, the Jews' religious obligations apparently, in their mind anyway, perhaps it, particularly with respect to food and dietary restrictions, might have been what Paul is addressing. Maybe he's making a distinction here between some generalities and some specifics. We're left in the dark as far as why he said that. Because it does look like it's just being repetitious. But obviously they understood it, and the Holy Spirit did. Mike? Right.
Could it be in reference to the fact that many of them, from a conscience viewpoint, were under the law, even though they may have not, he didn't think that they needed to be, but he made that reference just because their conscience made them still think that they were under the law?
I think that's certainly a factor in this, that they still had that feeling of obligation and requirement to the law. And to observe that probably the dietary, in particular, given the context of chapter 8, the dietary restrictions of the law, which, again, Romans 14 deals with the same issue.
Tim?
Yes?
Could it have something to do with approachability to Jews that are not Christians or have heard his teachings for the first time? If he was living as if he was under the law, or as if he were a Jew, and obeying their traditions, then he could approach them as an equal.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what he means here. And in fact, he brings the Gentiles into the picture, then he says, "I do all things for the gospel's sake." Verse 23. Everything that he did with an eye toward, how is this going to enhance my ability to reach people, gain, in the language of this text, to gain these people so that their souls will be saved, Jew or Gentile? Yeah.
Because that's how how he approached a new city when he went the first time.
Mm-hmm.
He'd go to the Jews first.
Yeah, if there was a Jewish, either a synagogue or a... somebody there that, or the, like, you know, like Lydia in Philippi. You know, if he found out that there were some Jews meeting somewhere, he went to them. Yeah. Whatever it took, without violating the law of God and the will of God, that whatever he could do to adjust his lifestyle, to accommodate himself to any local customs or traditions or religious practices that were not contrary to the law of God, whatever he could do to facilitate his work, he did it. And that included, of course, the foregoing of the liberties that he mentioned earlier in the chapter. Well, I know that our time's about gone, so Ed?
So, following what his defense is for being an apostle.
Okay.
Is it just narrowed down to verse 18 where it's talking about that Christ called him, or is there other arguments there as to why he should be considered an apostle?
No. Yeah, there are other points that he makes in it. In the first part of the chapter, one of the strongest arguments that he makes has to do with the fact that, as he says in verse 2, you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. The word seal there was a reference to an obvious example of authentication. You know, whenever something is authentic, and I remember... whenever I had to get my driver's license in California, and this is the first time this had ever happened to me, they said, you have to have a birth certificate. And I said, well, I've got this birth state, you know, this thing that the hospital filled out. No, you have to have your birth certificate with the, you know, official seal of the state of Texas on it. And so I had to, you know, spend $15, whatever, and send off and get it. That he said, you are authentic evidence to the fact that I'm an apostle. So that's the first argument that he made, is that the church there and the people that had been receptive to his teaching and preaching is an example or exhibit number one in this. Well, I'll make a list of those next week. We'll go over those, because that's a good question, you know, so that we don't lose the thread of the big picture here.